This is something that we've been trying to get the state to come round on. I think we've made huge progress.
The tricky issue of defining the boundaries of tribal jurisdiction in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a village starts up a new dance group in honor of Chemai.
Keep in mind, this is the first time in over 100 years that Quinnahock has had a dance group.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The executive in charge of Shell's troubled Arctic drilling program is stepping down. David Lawrence was Shell's vice president for North American exploration. He's been with the company for almost 30 years. Now, a spokesman says he's leaving, quote, by mutual consent. Shell won't say whether Lawrence's departure has anything to do with the 2012 drilling season, but it's only been a week since the Department of Interior released its review of Shell's Arctic program. Interior's investigators said Shell wasn't fully prepared for the logistical challenges it faced in the Arctic. Lawrence made headlines a year ago when he told a Dow Jones reporter that drilling in the Arctic would be, quote, relatively easy. He said the oil Shell is pursuing in the Alaskan Arctic is located in shallow, low-pressure areas that are simpler to access than other deposits. A Shell spokesman declined to comment on Lawrence's departure. The recent reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act had many applauding its new protections for LGBT victims and illegal immigrants. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation supported the bill. One of the reauthorization's new, more controversial provisions, granting tribal courts jurisdiction over non-natives for domestic violence crimes committed in Indian country, has reopened a long simmering debate about tribal power in Alaska. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Myron Nanning is the president of the Association of Village Council Presidents. He says tribes in the lower 48 are celebrating the new authority they've won, but not in Alaska. Because, Nanning says, the state does not recognize tribal powers.
The state's position is that anybody that moves into a village that's not a non-tribal member should not be handled by a local tribal court. But, you know, we move into urban centers ourselves, and then we're subject to state courts.
The federal government still recognizes Alaska tribes, even though most relinquished Aboriginal rights and territory, known as Indian Country, when Congress passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Residents in Metlakatla opted out of ANCSA. Metlakatla is the only reservation in the state and the only federally recognized Indian country in Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski inserted an amendment in the Violence Against Women Act that, she says, was clearly designed to ensure Metlakatla's increased court jurisdiction.
In Alaska, the only Indian country, the only reservation is Metlakatla. So I wanted to make sure that Metlakatla was going to be treated similarly as to all other reservations, all other land in Indian country.
But there's been pushback from Nanning and others who say more should have been done to make sure the new provision applied to all Alaska tribes. Senator Murkowski says the Violence Against Women Act was not the place to hash out territorial disputes. And to the tribes who were looking to gain increased rights, she says that conversation can be had at a later time.
I think that there are some who viewed this as an opportunity to gain an inch on this issue and then kind of build on it from there.
The U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the state's lack of Indian country in 1998. Senator Murkowski says Congress would need to amend the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to create Indian country. John Havelock was the Alaska Attorney General when the Native Claims Settlement Act passed. He says the act was described as an alternative to what at the time was considered a failing reservation system and was not designed to take away tribal authority.
There was not any side discussion of tribal authority. In fact, I think a lot of people assumed that the village corporation system would replace any tribal jurisdiction. But when you think about it and look at it, you can see, well, wait a minute.
Mike Garrity is the current Attorney General for Alaska.
The state's position is that we're in favor of the law and it currently exists and the jurisdiction that the tribal courts currently have.
Garrity says state courts have jurisdiction over the entire state.
These people, whether they're members or non-members of the tribe, they're also citizens of the state of Alaska. They have constitutional rights under our state constitution.
In Indian country, tribal courts have sole jurisdiction within the designated boundaries, and state courts have none.
I'm not in favor of disrupting that balance and creating, you know, 229 checkerboard, 229 jurisdictions and tribal court jurisdictions, and then, you know, where the physical boundaries of those would be, who knows?
Because there are not defined borders like the reservation system has. Garrity says the state cooperates with tribal courts on issues under the Indian Child Welfare Act and child support cases. It also recognizes and enforces protective orders from certain tribal courts. Senator Murkowski says the state needs to be pushed on the issue of tribal jurisdiction, that the state has for too long feared relinquishing any authority to the tribes. She says she's introducing a plan that would cross-deputize village public safety officers. It would allow them to hand out punishments throughout a village.
Fines or forfeiture or community service or even banishment. And it gives them that authority. This is something that we've been trying to get the state to come round on. I think we've made huge progress.
The plan is being reviewed by both tribal leaders and state officials. And in Murkowski's eyes, it gives the state a chance to see there is nothing to fear in granting tribes more authority. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A bill that would require a longer probationary period for teachers has attracted opposition from labor organizations. Right now, public school teachers in Alaska can earn tenure after 3 years of employment within the same district. This bill would bump that to 5 years. Before they get tenure, teachers can be let go without cause. But after that, school districts must notify teachers and put them on an improvement plan before firing them, unless there are extreme circumstances. Tammy Wilson, a Fairbanks Republican, is the bill's sponsor. She says school districts came to her asking for the change. By changing the tenure rules, she argues that they would have more flexibility to hire teachers who meet their needs. Wilson also says her intent is to give teachers more time to develop their skills before being judged by districts.
We want to be fair to the teacher and make sure that they have had time to get their feet on the ground, be effective. I don't think this is about keeping ineffective teachers longer. I think it's actually giving them more time to show what they really are capable of.
But leaders of the Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai associations called in to say that the bill isn't about accommodating teachers. They argue that the bill is instead an attack on job security. Joe Boyle is the president of the Mat-Su Education Association, and he says the change would make it harder for the state to attract teachers.
For 5 years, you'll have no job protection. If an administrator needs to make room for a friend or family member, you're gone. If you ask too many questions at a staff meeting, you're done.
The bill is being held in committee for more testimony. Anchorage Assemblymember Paul Honeyman is trying to slow down the process to pass a controversial Anchorage ordinance that would limit unions. He introduced a resolution at a work session at City Hall today. Honeyman proposed a resolution that would postpone action on the ordinance for 6 months. He says there are still too many questions about the overhaul of labor law to move forward. Honeyman's resolution can be adopted by the Assembly with 6 votes. He says it's essentially a directive to the Assembly.
Gives us the time, the Assembly, the administration, labor organizations, and outside labor interest groups to sit down in a collaborative manner in a work committee or a task force, however you want to call it, and literally pick apart this ordinance. I mean, you hear one side, you schedule a week later, you hear another side, and each of the Assembly members, as you can see, still have lists of questions coming through.
Although a new version of the ordinance was presented at the work session, several members expressed concern that the document did not incorporate some changes that members were expecting to see. The proposed ordinance was announced on February 8th by Mayor Dan Sullivan. It would limit union longevity, performance pay, benefits, and eliminate binding arbitration, along with strikes. It would also allow some municipal jobs to be contracted out. Sullivan says the changes are needed to keep costs down, and the ordinance must be rushed because of upcoming union negotiations. Union leaders representing 2,200 or so municipal employees offered a one-year wage freeze in exchange for tabling the ordinance, but the Sullivan administration turned them down. Honeman plans to introduce his resolution at Tuesday's regular assembly meeting, the same meeting at which the ordinance is scheduled for action. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, setting research priorities for the Arctic and the people who live there.
They're disconnecting from the local food system, which puts them at greater risk for food insecurity and for development of chronic diseases.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Mat-Su Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The U.S. Arctic Research Commission is in Bethel for their 100th meeting. The commission is an independent federal agency that helps plan Arctic research goals on the national level. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
There are eight commissioners, four of them from Alaska, including Mary Pete of Bethel. Pete says it is their first time meeting in the Bethel region, and their visit is two-part. They hope to learn more about the Yupik people, and they are also releasing their 2013-2014 goals report.
Often what happens with our goals report, it's cited in research proposals, in grant proposals, that what they're trying to do aligns with the national priorities.
Commission Chair Fran Ulmer officially released the goals Thursday evening. She said the five essential goals haven't changed. To observe, understand, and respond to environmental change in the Arctic, to improve Arctic human health, to understand natural resources, to advance civil infrastructure research, and finally, to assess Indigenous languages, identities, and cultures.
They haven't changed because, first of all, they're very broad and encompassing, but because when we listen to people who live in the Arctic region, people who do research in the Arctic region, people who are about to make decisions about the Arctic, these remain sort of the big five.
Listening to local researchers has been a big part of the commission's Bethel trip. Thursday, they heard from Bethel Mayor and YKHC Medical Director Joe Klaika. He talked about many brow-raising statistics within the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta compared to the lower 48. The disparities include higher unintentional deaths, cancer, suicides, alcoholism, and dental disease. Klaika said the dental problems start before children enter school, oftentimes leading to major surgery.
We were doing, between us and Anchorage, for people from our region, 450 full mouth restorations on kids before the age of starting school here a year. 75% of our children. That's just an astounding amount of disease.
The reasons stem from a number of things, including lack of services such as running water. Not counting Bethel, the region's hub, about 45% of homes still use honey buckets. When talking about social ills like alcoholism and suicide, Klaika said they are symptoms of a huge breakdown in culture. That stemmed from westernization, when whole communities died from diseases like TB, children being taken from homes to attend boarding schools, and now children idealizing what they see on television, something far removed from their village reality. Klaika, along with other local speakers, said a key to healthy Arctic communities is keeping cultures alive. That includes health benefits from a traditional Yupik diet, which is high in omega-3 fats, vitamin D, and good cholesterol. Andrea Bersaman with the Center for Alaska Native Health Research told the commission that the younger the Yupik person is, the less traditional diet they are eating. Among 14 to 19-year-olds, less than 10% of their food is coming from a traditional diet, compared to diets of people over 60 who eat about 50% traditional foods.
So that's concerning because they're disconnecting from the local food system, which puts them at greater risk for food insecurity and for development of chronic diseases.
Bersaman's team has research going to counter the trend of moving away from a traditional diet, which is called fish to school. It puts local fish on school menus once a week. 2 school districts in the region are participating in the pilot project.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Dozens of dance groups will be performing this weekend in Bethel at the annual Chamai Dance Festival. One of them will be a student group from the village of Quinnahock. The students had to receive special permission from their elders to dance after it was banned in the village for decades. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Sophie Ivan has more.
Quinnahock is about 100 miles downriver from Bethel. The village of about 700 sits on the south side of the Kuskokwim Bay on the Kanichtuk River. The Quinnahock School is called Quinnahock Miut Litnarvat. Bethel Council on the Arts and Jamai Coordinator, Linda Kurda.
And for the first time, Quinnahock is going to be joining us. This is their first dance. As a community, they haven't danced in, someone said, 80 to 100 years. So we're thrilled to have Quinnahock be joining us.
Quinnahock Miut Litnarvat principal, Eric Peterson, invited storyteller Jack Dalton and well-known Yupik composer, drummer, and singer Asi Kairayok to the school last year for a week of teaching students how to dance the Yupik way. Jack Dalton.
They were really, really excited. And so the kids went to the Elders Council and asked if they could have a dance group. Keep in mind, this is the first time in over 100 years that Quinnahock has had a dance group.
Dalton says the elders insisted that there be no Yupik spirituality in the dances in order to honor the Quinnahock Moravian Church, which Dalton says does not allow any kind of dancing, Yupik or Western.
So the fact that the Elders' Council agreed that there could be Yupik dancing is pretty big. And because there's the stipulation that there shouldn't be anything spiritual about the dancing, there wouldn't be any of the first dancing rites or ceremonies to take place. So we're just doing these as social dances.
Dalton says the students came up with their own stories to tell through dance. They will dance about a huge fall storm a couple of years ago, which forced the kids inside, and where elders taught them how to make dolls out of grass. They will also tell the story about their river, Kanichtuk, whose main channels are always changing. 17-year-old high school student Alexi Galila is one of the dancers. He's the son of Walter and Dorothy Galila.
We've only been practicing for a week for the Jamai Festival. I feel great. Learning the moves and learning the songs, coming through my body like nice and smooth.
Galila says he's confident about Quinnahock's first dance performance.
I see big smiles and they're getting the hang of it. And just like the older group, they got the hang of it, and then the kids are right behind us following our moves and stuff.
Quinnahock is scheduled to dance each day of the 3-day Jamai Festival. Their first performance will be Friday night at 6 p.m. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Ivan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through PIC-CLIC-GIVE or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, John Muir. Muir is one of the most renowned naturalists of the last 2 centuries. President Theodore Roosevelt turned to Muir when planning America's first national parks. In the late 1800s, Muir decided to journey to the far north, and the first stop on his great Alaskan expedition was Wrangell Island in the Inside Passage. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver traces the history of Muir and Wrangell from his first steps on the island to his continued influence today.
The Wrangell village was a rough place. No mining hamlet in the placer gulches of California,
nor any backwoods village I ever saw, approached it in its picturesque, devil-may-care abandon.
That's Mike Simons reading an excerpt from John Muir's book, Travels in Alaska. Along with being the general manager of Wrangell's radio station, Simons is an avid Muir buff. He says, in May 1879, Muir boarded the steamer Dakota in San Francisco, bound for the wild north. He hoped to study some of the largest glaciers in America. He made stops in Oregon and British Columbia before finally reaching the territory of Alaska on July 14th. Muir was impressed by the great fjords and mountains of the Inside Passage that he saw from the ship. But his first impression of an Alaskan town left something to be desired.
Stumps and logs, like precious monuments, adorned its two streets. The ground, in general, was an oozy, mossy bog of a foundation of jagged rocks, full of concealed pit holes. There was not a horse on the island. The domestic animals were represented by chickens, a lonely cow, a few sheep, and hogs of a breed well calculated to deepen and complicate the mud of the streets.
Samuel Hall Young was the reverend of the Presbyterian Church in town. He would go on to travel up the Stikine River with Muir, but he first saw Muir while waiting at the shore to greet the travelers as they arrived. He noticed the strange, weather-beaten man on the ship as it came in.
Standing a little apart from them as the steamboat drew to the dock, his peering blue eyes already engagingly scanning the islands and the mountains, with a lean, sinewy man of 40, with waving reddish-brown hair and beard and shoulders slightly stooped. He was introduced as Professor Muir, the naturalist.
Kay J. Bush is the director of the Wrangell Public Library. She's holding a small blue book with yellowing pages. She reads the inscription scribbled on the first page.
This book, Alaska Days with John Muir by S. Hall Young, was presented to the Wrangell Public Library by the author, S. Hall Young, Wrangell, Alaska, October 28, 1921.
Jay Bush says having the personally inscribed book makes this community history real for readers today. Muir writes in his book that he can't find a place to camp for the evening, so he hikes up the mountain rising from the center of town. He says he hopes to find a more suitable place to camp in nature. When he gets to the top of the mountain, he builds a bonfire for warmth and to see the forest around him. The sky is overcast and the clouds are low and heavy. The fire reflects off the clouds in brilliant reds and oranges. As the story goes, Reverend Young and the townspeople are scared by the strange lights on the mountain. They eventually learn that it was just the naturalist keeping warm, but that night is still a rich part of local lore. Muir writes,
I've enjoyed thousands of campfires in all sorts of weather and places, but this Wrangell campfire, my first in Alaska, I shall always remember for its triumphant, storm-defying grandeur and the wondrous beauty of the psalm-singing, lichen-painted trees which it brought to light.
That place is now called Mount Dewey, but its first name, and one that some locals still use, was Muir Mountain.
The significance of Muir with Wrangell is that these exploratory trips, which put Glacier Bay on the map and made it the tourist destination that it became, these trips of such importance were started from Wrangell, Alaska, and would terminate in Wrangell, Alaska.
Muir continued on his journey through the Inside Passage and went on to travel across the interior and as far north as Barrow. But Muir writes, he'd always remember the rough and tumble town of Wrangell as the place his Alaskan adventure began. Following the footsteps of John Muir in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to a city, the capital city to be more specific, Juneau.
My name is Ricardo Wuerl, and I'm from Juneau, Alaska, CEO for Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority. You know, Juneau is the capital of Alaska, and we're located in the middle of a rainforest, so a lot of big trees. We're surrounded by mountains that come right down to the water. You know, being a rainforest, we do have a lot of overcast days. cloudy a lot. You might hear complaints from our northern legislators who talk about not being able to get into Juneau because of weather. But boy, on the nice days, we make up for all the crappy days in the year. More than 50%, I think it's even more than 60% of our population works in government because we are the capital. They either work for the state or they work for the federal government. You know, aside from that, we have a lot of typical seasonal employment and jobs like tourism and mining. We also have access to all of traditional subsistence foods or, you know, natural wildlife resources, hunting and fishing. You know, it isn't as much of an effort to go out and do hunting and fishing as it might be, say, in, you know, in Anchorage or Fairbanks. The mountains are fantastic for camping and hiking. And, you know, a lot of the offices here also go to summer hours. So you work longer throughout the week, and then maybe like Friday you get off early so people can get a jump on the weekend just to be outdoors.
Ricardo Wuerl is CEO for Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shady Grove Oliver, Alex Duerre, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Angela Denning Barnes and Sophie Ivan in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.